Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 5, Chapter 8, The Character of Bharat Maharaj, Text 18 in prose. Apichana vrika shalariko yatamo na naikai chara eko eka charun va bak sayati. Word for word. Apicha, or na, not vrika, a wolf. Sala vrika, a dog. Dogs and wolves are obviously related. Anyatamaha, any one of many. Va, or na eka charaha, the hogs that flock together. Eka charaha, the tiger that wanders alone. Va, or Baksayati is eating the poor creature. Translation. I do not know, but the deer might have been eaten by a wolf or a dog or by the boars that flock together or the tiger who travels alone. Srila Prabhupada gives a very small, very, very philosophical purport. So you have to listen very carefully to this purport. Tigers never wander in the forest in flocks. Each tiger wanders alone, but the forest boars keep together. Similarly, hogs, wolves, and dogs also do the same. Thus, Maharaj Bharat thought that the deer had been killed by some of the many ferocious animals within the forest. Om Gena Timrandasya Gena Jena Shalakaya Chakshu Un Minatamina Tasmai Shri Gurudenamaha. Apicha na vrikashala vriko na yatamo na nakachara ekacharo va baksa yati. I do not know, Maharaj Bharat thinks to himself, I do not know, but the deer might have been eaten by a wolf or a dog or by the boars that flock together. Or the tiger who travels alone. I was tempted to request another purport and text or permission to read the next one. But the next number of texts are all similar. They're these little snippets of Maharaj Bharat's thoughts. So I thought, okay, well, I might as well stay with what Providence has ordained. And try to build upon this very interesting text. The first obvious thing I could think about was dovetailing my love of nature programs. If anybody's watched nature programs of something in our family, we sit around and hear the latest David Attenborough revelation about some wonderful part of our world and the latest unique filming that they've done. So something I saw very recently, maybe about 2 years ago. Now they have a course with digital. Everything's digital. So they have these cameras now that can be attached to a helicopter, but it's like over 1 mile high. Because obviously, when they were filming nature things, it was all about proximity. How close could they get? Because the more close you got, the more it got your attention now, how close you were to the animal. But it was quite limited. But now they have cameras, these hundreds of thousands for each camera, attached to a helicopter a mile high in the sky. So they can film from that distance, and the animals are completely unaware. So with this latest digital technology. So I might as well engage a little of it now, because they had their latest, never filmed before, was this pack of dogs hunting an animal. And I think it was somewhere in Africa. And it showed the exceptionally complicated procedures that dogs would use, how to catch their target. The dogs would literally, you'd see them running, and then one group would break off, another group would break off, and then break off again and break off again. And they would gradually run some miles like this in small groups, and then come round their target and jump in. So it was, and they were saying, wow, this has never been filmed, never been seen before. Okay, great, but we always hear, and we hear here in Srimad Bhagavatam, animals travel in packs and do their necessities to get their food. But I have to say, the most amazing one was a pack of lions taking down an elephant. A pile of lions, and this was done at night time, but you had about five or six lions on top of a full adult elephant, and they'd get in the back and slowly just try and get one leg down, and it took a few hours, but like you'd have three lions hanging off the back of an elephant, and lions are big creatures, and tigers are big elephants are huge creatures, so it took three or four lions to jump on, and then they'd fall off, and the elephant keep moving. Of course, it's very pathetic as well. It's like, oh, it looks so terrible, but then that's the law of nature, which is permitted. But Prabhupada says here, and I can't confirm, tigers don't do that. Tigers wander alone, but the other animals keep together in groups. So, apart from a few interesting nature, sharing some nature moments from the compliments of the BBC, David Attenborough. Of course, I think because these texts, what they're doing, they're giving us insights to the thoughts of Maharaj Bharat. So I like the way this one starts. That's why I thought we could stay with it. Is I do not know. But maybe, so he's saying he doesn't know what the story is. He can't see the deer. His deer's wandered off. But then he thinks, well, maybe this could have happened, and maybe this could have happened, and maybe this or this or this. And they're all valid possibilities. They're in the forest, and there is wolves and boars and tigers, etc. But we know at this point, Maharaj Bharat's in Maya, he's fallen down from his spiritual practice. He's lost the deer, and now he's neglecting his spiritual duties. So, in Maya, one of the natures of the material energy is to create unnecessary anxiety. Anxieties that not required, not needed, unnecessary. I think I gave my last class on the topic of distress. So how distress goes through. We have distress before we become a devotee. Well, we have distress when trying to be a devotee. And then when we're pure devotees, we still have distress. And when we're completely perfected devotees, we have the topmost ecstatic distress. So distress is always there. So same with anxiety. Anxiety is always there. There's always anxiety. And we hear, it's connected, we hear of the residents of Vrindavan, a mother showed us continual anxiety when her beloved son wanders in the forest barefoot, and the thorns and the stones and the various demons she hears about. Oh, Mother Yashoda is in constant anxiety. And Srila Prabhupada liked to talk about take on some anxiety for Krishna. Take on some anxiety. So anxiety should be there. Something that keeps us on the edge. So we're always thinking, can I, Krishna, am I doing for you what I can do? Am I doing the best I can? Can I do more, Krishna? Some anxiety. And how that's appreciated by Srila Prabhupada and Krishna. But then there's unnecessary anxiety. And Prabhupada sometimes would, when devotees would propose a certain project, and you have different quotes throughout Prabhupada's, especially the letters, seem to come up more so. Prabhupada would say, encourage, yes, you take on this. This is a wonderful expansion of our Krishna conscious movement. No, don't do this. You're taking on an unnecessary burden, unnecessary anxiety. So he would, in different situations, say different things. But I kind of look at it more from the personal point of view, just on a simple, more, as opposed to thinking, should I open this big temple in this new city on my own? So much anxiety. Or should I take on this new service? So much anxiety. But just in little ways, we let our mind indulge in anxiety that's not required. And it's interesting because it is Maya. And like everything, Maya comes in many, many strange forms. So the form that, one form of Maya is that we enjoy being in anxiety. Anxiety becomes a source of pleasure for us in its own strange way. It's like, more obviously, I always say anger. We get great relish out of being angry. It's a great source of great foundation and rationalization to be completely absorbed in ourselves. 100%. What more does our false ego love than to be absorbed in ourself? So anxiety is the same thing too. It's another manifestation of our idea that I'm meant to be the Lord here. I'm meant to be the one that's keeping things in line or protecting the other ones or being compassionate and friendly. So much... these little ideas we have of ourselves in our God, in our idea that ourselves being some little God, we have anxieties, but they're unnecessary for the most part because we're not in control and we can only do a certain amount of things. And Srila Prabhupada would like to tell the story of the general incident of a parent who so loves their children, and the parents love their children and does everything to care for and protect the children, but the children may die. The children may die. With all the best love and all the best care, children may die. So much anxiety, so much care, but what can we do? And anxiety, it's just another outgrowth of our idea of ourselves as the Lord. And therefore the mind likes to have us in anxiety. So we feed our false ego and our idea that we are somehow or other a little Lord. So Maharaj Bharat here is especially if we don't know, if we're speculating, that's the point here, he's speculating, I don't know, but. And obviously it's a key area for us, we're always very key on please, but we shouldn't speculate. I think actually I appreciate she's not here. Vishakha Mataji is very good. A couple of times she's caught me, said, don't speculate. Okay. She wants to know what's the situation, what's the details. Shouldn't speculate. It's always a little pointed reminder, and I appreciate it because I do watch my own tendency to speculate. Okay, first find out the facts. What's the facts of the situation? What's involved? And then do something. But here we just, our mind thinks, well, maybe this could have happened, maybe this, and maybe this, and maybe the... So much anxiety. So So Maya, in the material world, we create sense gravitation in so many strange ways, so many strange forms. We engage in sense gravitation. It's not just the most in its grossest way, and that's why, as devotees, therefore, we can bring this into our spiritual life and cling on to this type of sense gratification. We get just anxiety about, well, what will happen to me in 1 year from now? What will happen to my service? Or if I go here, what will happen to my prasadam today? Or we cling on to this idea that I'm providing for myself, or I don't endeavor like this, or I don't plan like this, it won't work out nicely. But it's a little indication of our lack of faith in Krishna yet. Krishna is caring for and loving for us more than we can possibly imagine. We can't imagine it, literally, how much Krishna is taken to our every little need. And as we practice as devotees, we gradually see a little bit by little bit how nicely Krishna has arranged things. Everything's come just the way I want it now. So Krishna's arranged things very nicely. He's not negligent, Prabhupada said. Krishna's not negligent in taking care of us. He takes care of the animals all the time. He takes care of the non-devotees. What to speak of his devotees or those who are trying to be his devotees, Krishna takes very, very careful attention. So as devotees, we should be... I think when we read of Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur, those symptoms of anista bhajana kriya, there's various psychological things. Should I do this, or should I change like this, or maybe I'll be like this now, or maybe I'll be... They're all actually just anxieties. Unnecessary anxieties of the neophyte. They're nice concerns. I'm concerned about my spiritual life, but you shouldn't be so concerned. Just do your service, do your sadhana, follow what you've been told, and Krishna will take care of everything. We have to live that faith as best as we can. And then there's some just general points about, so he says, I do not know, but the deer might have been eaten by a wolf. So what we're seeing is Maharaj Bharat's affection here. He's developed the affection for the deer. And as we've heard, I think, most in the classes about this section, the importance of association. Ramana Mataji has said a number of times that the key thing that's happened here is that he didn't have association. And so the importance of association. I'd like, just for the purpose of my little talk here, a little fine tune of that is that the importance of association, but the importance of affection, which is something we get when we're in association. We will have, and we will exchange affectionate dealings. So Maharaj Bharat, even though we hear the exalted platform of his consciousness, but what is the benefit, or what is the glory of anything unless we have someone to exchange it with, to share it with, some affectionate dealings with somebody, and the problems we will get into if we don't have these affectionate dealings. When we have our retreats back in Ireland on Inishrath, if somebody, they're usually new age groups, and very often some impersonal thing will come up at some point. Somebody will say something that has an impersonal twinge to it, and I like to try and very quickly establish that we don't really want impersonalism. As a philosophy, it has a certain superficial attraction, but as Sridhananda Maharaj used expression, in the trenches, which means when we get really down to the work of doing something, we want, it's all about personism. It's all about being with people. And I give the example of winning the lottery. If somebody wins the lottery and you win 5 million euros, what meaning is that 5 million euros unless you can tell someone? If you win 5 million euros and you're not allowed to share, or not allowed to tell anybody, not allowed to do it, what meaning is it, 5 million euros? I tell them. The first thing you ought to do is tell somebody. Anything has value only in relationship, basically.
particularly money, which people value so much externally, but it's not really the money that we value. It's not the money. It's the relationship I will have based upon having this money. Things are only of value to the degree that they become a platform for my developing a relationship with somebody, developing an exchange. So otherwise they have no value. So everything is based upon some exchange, some relationship, and therefore how important it is to have affectionate exchanges, affectionate relationships. On the negative side of this, obviously, what happens when we don't have affection, and it seems like Maharaj Bharat here, a lot of details aren't spelled out, but when he's there doing his puja, this deer came along and he grew, and his affection to the deer developed because he must have been lonely. He actually must have been lonely. I can see it myself, actually, kind of often the tendency, especially cute little puppy. When I grew up, we always had puppies. So now if I see a cute little puppy, I just go, I'd still love to have a little puppy. I can sense the I was thinking actually this thing about in the West, about cows and dogs, right? We have this thing that the cow, the literature says, is the most important creature for its value. But the West has absorbed dogs. Dogs have become the big thing, you know, the whole structure that developed around dogs. And I was thinking one reason why, possibly, because dogs, at least externally, they show a lot of affection. Cows don't. They can, we know they can, especially if we hear in Krishna book, cows come running down the hill to feed their calves, and when Krishna stops, they come running and all stare at Krishna. That's in the spirit world. But even here, like Surya Kunda, be able to tell us when he comes down with his morning breakfast for the cows, they come running towards him, mooing for their morning feed. But with dogs, it's very like they can get very intensely affectionate, running around you and licking legs and jumping up and wanting your attention. This is quite an intense expression of affection. This seems to indicate the fact in the West that this has become such a big thing, that the West were inherently incredibly lonely. There's so much loneliness. And actually not so much loneliness. You could take this different levels. From the very idea of the living entity coming to the material world, we're inherently going to be lonely. It's a constitutional fact that of our conditioned mentality in the material world, we will be lonely. Because what we're doing is we're trying to put ourselves in the center. We're trying to be Krishna, and nobody else is. I'm God, no one else is. The philosophy tells us, we know it doesn't work. There is only one God, and it's Krishna. So that consciousness of I am the center, because it's so alien, it's so wrong, we will inherently always be lonely. Intrinsically, in our heart, we will feel loneliness until we come back to our original spiritual consciousness. So material consciousness, loneliness will be there. But then in the West, the whole structure it makes it much worse. It's become much more prevalent. Bhakti Vikas Maharaj was saying in one of his little books that how in Bangladesh or Bengal, and I assume through most of India, specifically he's talking about Bangladesh, loneliness doesn't exist. It's just not a problem. People just don't get lonely. Because the whole value system that they have is we so much need each other. We need each other through all the problems and struggles of life and just the social things that they give value to are social exchange. But in the West, it's much the whole industrial ethos is about ourselves creating being the individual and creating our little castle. We protect ourselves and our situation. It's much more about the individual. But the individual has got no meaning. It's all about exchange. And then we hear especially about cities, right? Big cities. And the problem of loneliness. People are so lonely. Dogs. So people have, we hear people have taken dogs as and cats as companionship, because there's so much a need for it there, and they externally, even though by Vedic standards they're considered low class and unclean creatures, would not have not much practical use. But because everybody's got such problems of loneliness, that they absorb and have taken up this thing. So Maharaj Bharat here obviously has this problem. I had one nice book so many years ago called The Changing Face of Priesthood. And it was written by a priest whose job was to counsel other priests. And he was kind of going through the sad facts of the state of the Christian church, and the numbers, not people not joining and people leaving, and it's all a very old generation of people now having to do so many duties. And he did a nice section about why priests leave the priesthood. And he basically concluded that even with so much, even if their following was very nice and their practice was nice and their duties was nice, it was always a fundamental sense of loneliness that caused someone to leave, because they didn't have, and he used the word, a sense of intimacy was missing. A sense of someone who I could really be at ease with and be at comfort with and share, kind of open myself to in a very non-judgmental way. Now, that word non-judgmental, we have to look at it carefully from our perspective, but someone who we can be very open with, at least. And he kind of, so he said, for priests to survive, there has to be this sense of intimacy. Someone who we are convinced cares about us, really cares about us. And this, of course, has become, in ISKCON, this has become very much a strong surge in developing our society, how we have to have, and we are developing a stronger and better institution, but to make sure while we're doing that we don't sell out on the most important thing that everybody has come here for, and that's care. Everybody's come for some love and some care, some attention, some our conviction that Krishna has it for us, and then our experience that some specific devotee has it for us, and then a society where we all do it for each other. There's a caring society. And so that's why the care for devotees has become a strong push in so many places, and we see the results of it in Chapati, which I say, it's not, Chapati of course hasn't changed our philosophy, it's just changed the culture, where it's put this such a strong emphasis on care. Unless people feel cared for, they will leave. Because of having, in the material world, having tried for so long to have relationships in a way that excluded Krishna, and therefore only left us with, I think it's one, the Dyapadi, I'm not, it's a vague recollection, to the parched desert of the heart. Material consciousness, material life has made our heart like a vast, expansive, dry desert. And we see deserts like the Sahara Desert and the Kalahari Desert and deserts in so many places, and they're vast, dead places. They're not attractive at all. So in material world, where we have tried to go about creating what we've had with Krishna and Krishna's and our fellow parts and parcels in Krishna's world, where we have nice relationships as mother, as friend, as lover, and try to create it here, and being consistently disappointed from time immemorial has left us very, very burnt, very dried, because it's constantly being frustrated. So we come to Krishna consciousness convinced now that we will find a place where we will somehow or other get start to water our parched heart and find some care. But it's not easy, it's work. David Mita Maharaj has brought a very, very, very nice little book called Bhakti Bhav. And he really deals with this topic of the importance of emotional exchanges in Krishna consciousness. Because he explains, kind of says how, well, as a neophyte tendency, there's the tendency to we base ourselves very much on a philosophical ground. I had the philosophy right, and it convinces me, and it's nice. But we understand, as we heard yesterday, the day before, the different categories of devotees. And one category of devotee is ability to make relationship. We categorize the neophyte as a certain type of relationship. The Majjhim gets real relationships. And then the Uttam has got a different type of relationship again. So we come looking for relationship. We come looking for caring and deep relationships. But they're work, and we have to understand that. It's like everything else. We're not going to suddenly... devotees leave because, well, I didn't feel cared for. Or we have to think, well, did you show care for others? I was thinking, somebody could say, well, no one loves me. Or no one cares for me. I didn't feel cared for. Well, we have to say, well, did you care for us? Did you care for others? Did you show care for others? And that kind of it's got two sides to it. Showing care for others means people will reciprocate. But even a more fundamental level, if you show care for others, then, if we're not showing care for others, someone may care for us and we don't even feel it. We don't even see it. We don't perceive it. Because if we're not showing care for others, then we're just absorbing ourselves and we're in the modes of ignorance and passion. And the nature of ignorance and passion, we're not aware, we're not seeing somebody doing a nice thing for us, and we go, oh, great, thanks. Huh. We don't acknowledge it, we're not tuned in. But if we're in the mode of giving care, if somebody does something little for us, and I was thinking they're usually very small things, that's why I like the word affection. And actually, as a side philosophical point, even though, of course, in the Nectar of Devotion, it's actually described that our initial reverential devotion as devotees grows into love, which grows into affection. Which I liked that description because in our Western ethos, the word love is the big thing. Does anybody love you? Are you loved? Do you have love? Have you ever been loved? And have elevated this word and this whole concept to the topmost thing. But it's ridiculously blown out of proportions and ridiculously... got a very, sentimental and unfounded faith, and people's love gets burnt and disappointed and so on. But affection, and that's where I remember also an author, C.S. Lewis, describing about real, proper relationship, proper marriage is not based on this initial, this intense love. Is the love still real? Do you still love the person with the same intensity that you loved them when you first saw them? And he says, it's ridiculous, that can never last. What it grows into, if a marriage is going to sustain, is affection. Very nice, affectionate dealings. Each person's attentive to other things and does nice things for each other. And they're usually very small and very, what I'd call, very human little points of exchange. And I have one or two examples from Krishna doing that shortly. So affection, usually small things and little details that somebody knows about us and then they're attentive to. And we're very, very touched by it. We're always very touched by it. Recently I went back to Dublin to do some work on our restaurant. And then a week later, I got a nice package in the post, a big thank you card and a pack of socks. And I really wasn't expecting it, but I really appreciated it, especially the thank you card. All the staff had written inside it, we thank you for coming, you're still there for us. We love the help you did, the hard work, thank you very much. And I was like, oh, that was nice. I was very touched. So we so much need affection. We so much hanker for it, we need it. And even with all the philosophy is not complete. You have the philosophy and the culture, and the culture of care, the culture of developing affectionate dealings. Which, of course, Rupa Goswami, and she'll probably elaborate in his purport in Nectar of Destruction, the mediums of doing that. We eat together nicely, we talk together nicely, we sharing prasadam, we read our mind confidentially, and gifts, presents, nice presents. We've just come out of Christmas season where everybody tries to, and Prabhupada says in the purport, these things go on in the material world, any business deal, people sit down and you like something else, have a nice dinner, and then here's a little present, and then here's what I'm thinking. And Prabhupada says, in the material world it goes on. So Christmas now is a very official time, but I just, in the next day, in the front of the English paper, how eBay becomes extremely busy the day after Christmas, because everybody then tries to flog the Christmas presents that they've all got and they don't want. So, and we hear people taking out loans to get Christmas presents, and people then sell them the next day on eBay. It's like, it's all gone a little, we know it's quite silly. But the fundamental idea is very important. We do have to bring gifts and share gifts. So the affection dealings are there. So we need it very much, it's very important. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, emotional exchanges. Okay, sorry, just the specific point of affection. But anyway, so the importance of affection, and we can we hear repeatedly that in Srila Prabhupada's pastimes, devotees said this was the key thing practically, if not the main thing that brought them to Krishna consciousness, was some, just even one affectionate exchange with Srila Prabhupada, especially in the early days. It was when books weren't so much, and all they had was the Swami, and they were hearing this philosophy, and it sounded good, and they were learning it, but the real thing was the Swami, the Prabhupada's affectionate dealings. Just reading Mukunda Maharaj's book, Miracle on Second Avenue, he has a nice little thing about after Prabhupada came back from there, when he spent the time in San Francisco, and Mukunda Maharaj and Shyamasundara and Jamuna and they were building up San Francisco. Then Prabhupada went back to New York, and then he had the stroke. So then they said, okay, Prabhupada needs to rest. So then they came back to LA with Kirtananda and Haigriva Prabhupada, came back to LA, and then they brought him to this beach, Stinstone Beach. And Kunda Maharaj tells how, well, as soon as Prabhupada arrived, Haigriva Prabhupada was very frank. He says, we have to ask Prabhupada, if he dies, what will we do? What are we going to do if Prabhupada dies? And Kunda Maharaj was like, he was really taken aback by the frankness of the question. How could you consider thinking like this, Swami leaving us? But Haigriva was very insistent. No, we really, what do we do? And Kunda Maharaj said, he started to think about this. Oh, what? Yeah, okay, it's an important question. So he says, okay. So he goes up to Prabhupada's door, and knocks Prabhupada's door, and Prabhupada says, come in. And he goes straight down and sits in front of Prabhupada and says, Swami, what will we do if you die? Basically, what will you do? How will the institution go on? Who will teach us if you leave us? So as soon as Mukunda Maharaj said it, he felt, oh God, that was a... what have I just said? Straight away he felt himself, like even to anybody, you know, what will you do when you die? It's like, it's just a bit, but he did it. So he said, as soon as he said it, he felt wrong. And he said, Prabhupada sitting on his bed and looking out the window at the beach. And then Prabhupada said something. Mukunda Maharaj said he couldn't hear what Prabhupada said. He just, Prabhupada said something. So Mukunda Maharaj said, sorry, Swami, what was that? I couldn't hear it. And Prabhupada responds by saying, I won't get it right, exactly right now, but my spiritual master. Prabhupada takes a break, takes a pause, and he says it again. My spiritual master, he saved me. And Mukunda Maharaj said he could see in both eyes, two streams of tears come down Prabhupada's eyes. Prabhupada turned his eyes in and looked at Mukunda Maharaj directly and said, he saved me. The first thing Prabhupada said, actually, Prabhupada's first response was, actually, he didn't use the word offensive, he said even a stronger word, a very personal word. Actually, it's offensive to ask that, but he didn't use the word offensive, he used a very personal word. It was really like, it was really very strong, very hurt, very... So that's a Prabhupada said first. Actually, it is offensive to ask that question. But my spiritual master, he saved me. My spiritual master, he saved me. And tears in his eyes. So Mukunda Maharaj just, like again, said, oh, he just wanted to sink into the ground. He said, oh, what have I done? So he immediately said, okay, Swami, bowed his head and walked out the door. And Kirtananda and Haigriva, who had been waiting, were like, they are waiting. And Mukunda Maharaj just walks straight past them, goes out the front door and sits down and goes like... And it was seemingly in the book, even though he's gradually showing his more devotion to Prabhupada and more his affection, this was it. He said, this was it. This person, he saw Prabhupada's intense affection for his spiritual master and the intimacy, and then he felt it for him. Suddenly he felt it for Prabhupada. Prabhupada's saving me. And he really wanted to go out and just feel the moment. And that, he said, it was just a very, very, it was a strong, big moment. And it was done in such an affectionate way. It was about the emotion, the affection that Prabhupada was feeling, and he's sharing that emotion with Mukunda Maharaj, that Mukunda Maharaj really just felt drawn into Prabhupada and drawn into being a devotee. And so so it's very, very, very much about Prabhupada. So, and we hear that so many pastimes, because we hear the affection of Prabhupada in relation to, like, he's, he was like a father. He was always caring, was always asking about, have the devotees gotten up prasad, are they healthy? And there's the one specific famous class where Prabhupada's giving a class and there's so much coughing going on, and Prabhupada suddenly stops the class and says, why is everybody coughing? Everybody's coughing, what is it? And then he gives for the next 15 minutes a lecture about, you must look after yourself, you must look after your health. But even, I've taken that to a next point, Shruti Kirti Prabhu talks, because, you know, he's quite frank, he says, his mood towards Prabhupada was even more, he loved this element of Prabhupada, this affection element. So he describes Prabhupada like a mother. Prabhupada's motherly dealings, that he was really caring and very, been very attentive to all lots of little things. Just one little one example, Shruti Kirti tells a story, he was massaging Prabhupada once, and the way he was massaging Prabhupada, Shruti Kirti had his feet sticking out. And Prabhupada was, Shruti Kirti, you could see, Prabhupada was looking at his feet. And he felt a little uncomfortable with this. And then Prabhupada eventually asks, was your mother beautiful? Shruti Kirti said, well, she's quite old now, but when she was young, yes, she was quite beautiful. Prabhupada said, I can see that by looking at your feet. And Shruti Kirti said, huh? Said, by looking at your feet, I can tell you had a beautiful mother. So probably some science that Prabhupada knew. But Shruti Kirti just, again, he felt so warmed. He felt like, oh, first of all, spiritual master looking at my feet, he shouldn't be doing that. And then just such a personal comment about his feet and his mother. And so Shruti Kirti, all these little these intimate dealings, they were very attractive. And of course, and Sasrupa Maharaj tells a very, very important key one for him when he was doing the early days, when he was typing up Prabhupada's manuscripts. And he'd probably give him the manuscript, and Sasrupa Maharaj would take it home, and then he'd come in and he would give it to Prabhupada. So one time he came in to give it, and it was the day after the first initiation. And Sasrupa Maharaj didn't turn up for the initiation. And the reason he didn't turn up was because he wasn't invited. And he felt he had to be invited. So when he's in there giving the manuscript to Prabhupada, Prabhupada gets a phone call, and on the phone call it's the details for the marriage. Prabhupada's arranging for the marriage of Mukunda and Janaki. And the two marriages he's arranging for. So after he's talking on the phone, he's got some details, and he puts the phone down, and then Prabhupada says directly, we are arranging a wedding, will you come to it? And Sasrupa Maharaj says, yeah. Immediately he liked this, he liked the personal invitation, he needed that little bit more affection from Prabhupada, that attention to bring him in. But he always said that it was a weakness, it was an unnecessarily need for Prabhupada's attention that he was hankering for. And Prabhupada sensed that, so when Sasrupa Maharaj turned to leave and Prabhupada was showing him to the door, just as he was walking out the door, Prabhupada said to him, if you love me, I will love you. And Sasrupa Maharaj didn't comment, he doesn't recall commenting, but he goes down the stairs and he runs down the stairs and runs down the street and he feels this real happiness, like, that's it, I have to love him. If I love him, if I give my affection to him, there's 100%, now I'm convinced, he will give it to me, because he said he would give it to me. He has the capacity to love me, and he will love me. I have to love him. So then he realized, I've got to come forward, I've got to make the steps, I've got to exchange the affectionate dealings. So as devotees, we have to think, if I'm not getting care, if I'm not getting affection, well, give some. And then we step forward and give it a little affection, give it a little care. And it will come to us. It will come back to us. And therefore, we will not have, hopefully, this problem of loneliness and feeling like, because that's why devotees leave. There's no other reason to leave Krishna consciousness. The philosophies gives us no reason, gives us all reasons to stay very clearly. But because we feel like we're not getting that affectionate, loving dealings that we're getting, we're losing our faith that is in Krishna consciousness, we fall back to the so-called type of relationship we had in material consciousness. And of course, that's there in the famous verse Prabhupada says, it's actually in Yayaravindakshvi Mukti Muninast. No. Avishuddha Buddha, you know, Avishuddha Buddha, the impersonalists who go up to the topmost Brahma Jyoti, and they're very pure, very exalted, and they're floating it's a spiritual realm, but they're just get incredibly lonely. It just gets too lonely because they're all just little dots of light floating around. So they say they come down to, again, mundane relationships. So we have to watch out for this, that we don't leave Krishna consciousness, giving up our conviction that the real relationships, the real existential love that we're looking for will only be found in Krishna's, among Krishna's devotees and with Krishna. And then just to finish on that point, as one little deal, because Krishna, Devamrita Maharaj says, and that's the right reason Krishna's God. He's the best emotional expression, or some term he uses. Krishna is the best at expressing his emotions. Like we hear God can be described in so many ways, but even with Vishnu and Lord Narayan, they're Krishna, but they don't express their emotions so much. But Krishna has the full range, or full gamut of all the emotions, and Vrindavan is constantly just this constant flow of emotional and affection exchanges. But one little one I always liked to picture is when Krishna is teasing Mother Queen Rukmini, and it's interesting, he's doing it because he is just after the pastime where Krishna got Rukmini a nice parijata flower, and then Krishna's other wife Satyabhama said, "Well, what's going on here? That's not fair." So then, okay, Krishna has to appease Satyabhama, so he goes to get a parijata tree. So then he thinks, okay, what happens next? Now I go back to Rukmini. Is she going to ask for a parijata forest, or where will this end? But she doesn't. Queen Rukmini doesn't do that, because this is not her mood. She's very, whatever Krishna gave her, she'll be very pleased. So Krishna was thought, okay, there's some chance of a more ras here. So he's a bit disappointed she's not asking for more, actually. He was looking for her to see her angry, like, oh, you've given her this, what about me? But Queen Rukmini doesn't do that. So Krishna then decides to I'm going to really go for and incite her anger. So here, Krishna, one day when he's sitting on the bedstead, and Rukmini's personally fanning the Lord, he gives all these lists. Well, by the way, Rukmini, you know you got it really wrong with me, like I'm just the wrong guy. I'm just like, only people who are inauspicious worship me, and people who are poor. And actually, you know the real reason I just married you? I just wanted to get back at them. Like I thought, wow! Like you can't get more hurtful. Like the reason I married you was just to get revenge on him. It's like, who would survive if your husband or your partner told you that? Like I don't really love you. It's just an act of revenge. It would break your heart. It'd be torturous. And Krishna gives that and gives him so many reasons to Rukmini. But Rukmini, she doesn't get angry and throw down the chamber and says, "What sort of?" What sort of behavior is this? I'm leaving you. She actually, because she's thinking that, well, Krishna's thinking all these bad things, so maybe he's going to like stop the marriage. Maybe he. So out of this, her intense exit, she goes through all these ecstatic symptoms, and then she collapses. She falls unconscious. She does drop him. She falls unconscious. And Krishna sees, whoops, this wasn't what he was expecting, he wasn't anticipating. And that's a nice, even that idea, like usually Krishna is like, he's doing things to create nice ras, but it's suddenly as if, whoops, that wasn't what I was expecting. So he goes over and he says, he manifests his four arms. With two arms, he grabs Rukmini to hold her up. And then with one hand, he dresses her hair. And with the other hand, he wipes away her tears on both sides of her face. She's crying intensely. And with his hand, he wipes her tears away. I like the meditation because it's, I guess maybe again because it's used a lot in the mundane imagery and mundane books and things, the idea of somebody coming and wiping out, don't worry, they come to us and wipe our tears away. So it's a very affectionate, very intimate little exchange. And so Krishna does that. So we can be assured that Krishna is doing that for us too, in very, very small, very intimate, very affectionate ways. He's looking out for us, and we just have to be convinced and do the best we can to create an affectionate, caring environment, and then wait for the day when Krishna is holding us up in his arms. Okay. 5:07, 5:09. Okay, so I'll stop it. Anybody's any questions, comments, or corrections? Yeah, because ultimately, and the care for others grows out of the first and foremost, our care for ourselves. That's where the ability to care, of course, basically, come we understand, is on the Madhyam platform, and the Madhyam platform is attained by seriously caring about our spiritual life. We take our bhajan seriously, we take our sadhana seriously, and we will move forward. And on that platform, then we can care for others. But the neophyte, the Kanishtha Adhikari, really can't do it. Something can be there, something can be institutionalized, and nice training can help. But the actual ability to care, like that's why even like book distribution, it's the most compassionate and broadest way to show care for the other living entities. But I don't do book distribution, but even those who do, like to actually say I care for the non-devotees, it's like, it'd be nice if we did, but reality we don't. Srila Prabhupada cares for them, and then we're just vehicles for his care. So as much as possible, then more again among devotees, as because we all have to very much take care of ourselves, but not leaving it at that point. Taking care of ourselves, which should then produce the fruit of the importance of taking care of myself by good sadhana, by following the orders of the spiritual master, and therefore helping others do that too. And from that platform, we will then we all move forward. Yeah. So it starts with ourselves, but it doesn't stop there. We have to care together.
Of course, I think when Krishna ultimately, even though he's God, but when he really, really, really does express his caring, he does it in such a way that he strips away the whole idea that he's God. So then he really gets a taste, the idea that if I show some care for somebody, I'm putting myself out for them. It's really, yeah, somebody just does something like if, I don't know, like people are like, maybe social welfare comes to example, that people are giving me money, but social welfare person doesn't care. They just sign the thing, give them the money. They don't care. So, but we're affected by someone who put themselves out for us, doesn't care. So that picture, that one picture, painting we have of Krishna carrying Nandamara's shoes on his head. I mean, Mother Yashoda and Nandamara are just like, they're completely like, just melted seeing Krishna, because I think he's falling and he's wobbling, and they're heavy shoes for him. He's such a small little baby. So when Krishna really wants to express his affection, he does it in the environment where it does look like it's a lot for him. It's hard work. He does work at expressing his care in that environment. So to get the real topmost taste of what it means to share indeed in affectionate ways. Okay, thank you very much. Grant Rajim Bhagavatam Ki, Jai Srila Prabhupada Ki, Jai.